is a continuation of moral issues in medicine. We're going to talk about abortion today. Those of you who may have come in since I introduced myself on Monday, I'm John Collins, and I'm a family physician from Spokane, Washington. 1973, the Supreme Court made their famous decision titled Roe versus Wade, which in effect struck down all of the restrictive state laws that were against abortion in this country. And since that time, abortion has been a legal matter now, and purely up to the discretion of the woman and the physician, providing she can pay for it herself. Okay, we'll come to that issue later. Looking at this book here, Human Medicine, Ethical Perspectives on New Medical Issues, they list prior to 1973 that there were on the average about 180,000 legal abortions per year, and there were medical reasons for these abortions, which I'll explain later. There was estimated to be 1,200,000 annual illegal abortions performed in the United States by various people. There was anywhere from 500 to 6,000 women who died because of these illegal abortions and the poor medical care which they received. There's no way of pinpointing the exact number. That this is just a range number which has been projected for that. Let's take a look at 1976, which I have the actual statistics for, which is the last published data, to look at what's happened since abortion became legal. In 1976, there were 1,100,000 documented pregnancies in teenagers in the United States that resulted in 500,072. I don't know how to pronounce that. These were live births. These were teenagers that gave that went through the birth process and gave live births. There were 152,000 miscarriages that year and stillbirths, and there were 378,500 abortions done in the United States that year. The illegitimacy rate increased during the years from 1960 to 74 by 52% among teenagers in the United States.
Say that again.
The illegitimacy rate increased from the period 1960 to 1974 in the U.S. by 52%.
Does that mean estimated conception or delivery?
No, that's measured on estimated conceptions. No matter what the termination or ending of the conception was. Since 1970, there has been a decrease in the proportion of unwed mothers of all ages who have given up their babies for adoption. It was 44% of mothers in 1970 who went on to give birth to a child, gave it up for adoption. In 1973, this had dropped to 38%, and the latest statistics show that this continues to drop dramatically. And this statistic primarily applies to Caucasians or whites. We're talking about pregnancy in teenage mothers who are white. They are less and less giving up their babies for adoption. Now, if you look at pregnancy in Negro, specifically teenagers, or the other groups, they routinely do not give up their children for adoption in very high percentages at all. So they have always not resisted giving up their children for adoption. We're talking about minority groups within our society. Does everybody understand that? Maybe I muddled that a little bit. Now, what are the present indications for abortion in our society, both for medical reasons? First of all, are the medical risks of a pregnancy. Very rarely, and I've seen two or three cases in my 10 years in practice, a woman becomes pregnant while she has a terminal illness with cancer or other diseases. And it is felt that the pregnancy would shorten her life considerably, and for that reason, the decision is given to her that she can have an abortion if she chooses to do so. And a few do do this. I've also seen a few women go through the pregnancy and give birth to the child, and I've been involved at least in one case where the woman died within the last month of her pregnancy, and so we didn't end up with either a mother or a child from that pregnancy.
Because of medical?
Because of the medical effects of the pregnancy on her and her terminal illness. This woman I was talking about had cancer. Okay. These are very rare that there are medical risks that abortion would be recommended for. Psychiatric implications of pregnancy. This is probably a much bigger category. I think any women here who've gone through pregnancy are aware of the emotional and psychiatric implications of pregnancy. And this probably is, when we're dealing right now, for instance, with Congress and their restrictive laws that they're making in terms of funding abortion for low-income people, this is probably the area that most physicians, if they believe in abortions and want to recommend them, would like to recommend it on the basis of the psychiatric implications of pregnancy and their long-term effects on the woman who is forced to go through a pregnancy that she doesn't particularly want to support. There are other implications, though. There are a certain amount of incest in our society and rape also. But both of these, of course, are rare things in terms of the total number of pregnancies that are considered for abortion. We are blessed nowadays with the technology that we can sample the amniotic fluid at about the third month of a pregnancy and do what we call a chromosome squash and study, which will tell us if there are any fetal abnormalities. And this is routinely, of course, recommended for women who are over 35 years of age, which there's a dramatic increase in congenital abnormalities after that magic number. And then also for women who have genetic predisposition to various diseases. And we are able at this time to detect significant chromosomal abnormalities in a fetus at that time, and a decision then can be made whether to continue a pregnancy or not on the basis of what the product of that pregnancy is likely to be. But again, that's a very small percentage. There are a lot of economic factors that certainly have a bearing on abortion in America today. The biggest factor right now is, and there's a lot of people saying that basically the poor are getting second class treatment nowadays because of the restrictive legislation that's come out of Congress. Congress right now has pretty well cut down completely on welfare coverage for abortion at this particular time. This, of course, is a real economic issue when you consider the full implications of it. The cost of an average abortion performed before The 12th week of pregnancy was about $200, and it's estimated now that a child who is produced and is raised on aid to dependent children, which is the largest segment of our present welfare budget, cost in excess of $500,000, or over half a million dollars cost the public to raise them to approximate age of 18 years of age. So there's a real economic difference there. And then there are, of course, population factors, which perhaps have some bearing on abortion. We all are concerned with the growth in population and its effects, and I think we in the United States especially have to have a great concern about this when we are such consumers of the world's raw materials and economic factors in relation to the rest of the country. Every child in this country consuming, or every person in this country consuming six or seven times what the average person in any other country does in the raw materials and economic advantages of this world.
Can I ask a question?
Sure can.
Yeah. $500,000 for one child to 18.
Mm-hmm. Aid to dependent children, this is AID, or ADC, I guess it is. This is what the latest figures are, and that's rising. That covers everything. That covers the welfare, that covers medical, food stamps, whatever, you know. That's what they estimate that it's cost.
That's per one child.
That's per one child, yeah. Also, I forgot to mention that a recent study of ADC showed that 75% or more, in some cases, of the children who are covered by that were children who were products of teenage marriages. So we are talking about these children are primarily the products of teenage marriages.
What percent did you say?
75%. So it's a significant percentage of those children. Now let me give you a little bit of perhaps the technical data of abortion. And we have, those of us who attended the session this morning saw those beautiful pictures of the fetus. They were approximately 8 to 10 week old fetus, the one that you saw sucking the thumb there. And you can see that fetus, for all intents and purposes, is a child. It at that point has all of the basic organs of the body that you and I possess. And everything that goes on from that particular point in pregnancy is for further maturation of those basic organs to develop the end product, which will be able to sustain life on its own.
What age did you
say? That was about 8 to 10 weeks. Now, technically, abortion is safest when it is performed before the pregnancy is 12 weeks along, or we're talking about 3 months of pregnancy. The greatest number of abortions that are done in this country are done in that time interval before 12 weeks into the pregnancy. That is the least expensive one, the safest one to be done for the mother. After 12 weeks of it becomes a much more complicated process. Up to the 12 weeks time, we can use what we call suction curettage, which basically means that the mother is taken in. She can be taken into the hospital or into a clinic setting. She has a curettage, which takes about 20 minutes. There's minimal amount of anesthesia used with it so that she really is not drugged out completely or anything. She usually recovers within from 2 to 4 hours and can walk out of the facility. So it's a half day kind of procedure when you're talking about it at that time. Over 12 weeks gestation, then it becomes technically more complicated, and we use what we call saline injection at that particular point. A needle is inserted into the uterus through the abdomen, and a certain amount of that amniotic fluid, which I referred to before, is withdrawn, and it's replaced with a super concentrated salt solution. This has the effect of, number one, killing the fetus, and number two, it draws in fluid into the uterus and expands it greatly and starts the process of a miscarriage, tearing away the placenta from the wall of the uterus, and a lot of times rupturing the bag of waters and begins the birth process. These women, usually they go into the doctor's office, have this procedure done, they go home and wait the results of the procedure to occur within the next few days. Some of them have a what would be termed a miscarriage at home, if you and the products of conception are totally expelled. They bleed and have perhaps a heavier than normal menstrual period for a period of time, and then they stop bleeding and have no further problems. Some of them do bleed unusually heavy. The products of conception are not totally expelled, and they have to be admitted to the hospital in a dilation and curettage done of the uterus to make sure that it's totally evacuated. And then whatever, if they had lost an excessive amount of blood, their blood would be replaced and they would be sent home from the hospital, and that's usually an overnight procedure. After 20 weeks or 5 months along in the pregnancy, then it's more complicated yet, because at that particular point the fetus is considered viable by most doctors. Nowadays, with our technology, with our neonatal intensive care units and such, we can take a child that's 5 months, 5 months along in gestation, weighs perhaps a pound, may weigh less than a pound, and with our modern technology, we can bring that child through and have life. It's a very long, costly process, as you might imagine, with a long hospitalization and lots of technology going into sustaining the life in this particular case. And it's not always successful. It's not 100% successful. It's probably depends a lot on the weight of the child, of what the actual statistics are as for viability. Now let me tell you a little bit about my involvement in abortion, and then we'll throw the thing open to the floor and hear what you might have to say about it and want to talk about it. I practice in a four-man group, and I do not do abortions myself. I looked at it and decided that I didn't feel comfortable with doing it myself. I do refer my patients for abortion if they make that option. The typical patient that I see as a family physician, and as most doctors see in the United States, is a girl 16, 17, 18 years of age who is pregnant out of wedlock. Much of the time, her parents don't know that she is pregnant. She has missed usually two periods at the time when she comes in to see us, and is in a great deal of anguish and distress. I feel that it's my role to minister to her, not to read her the riot act, to try and impress my morals on her, but to do what I think is in her best interest and in helping her to make a decision which is going to affect her for the rest of her life. So basically, after I get her calmed down and try to reassure her and explain to her that I'm human too, and that I can understand exactly what she's going through, and that I really want to help her. And then we sit down and we look at the three possibilities. The three possibilities are basically to go through the pregnancy and keep the child, to go through the pregnancy and give up the child for adoption, and to have an abortion. So we talk about those issues, each one of them, all of the implications of them. Of course, going through a pregnancy and keeping the child, I talk about the fact that I feel every child should have a mother and a father, basically. And I think that's the ideal situation. That's not saying that she may not marry in a few years and have a happy marriage and supply that father for that child. So she has to look at that. She has to look at how she would feel going through that particular pregnancy and giving up the child for adoption. And this, as you can imagine, is a very tension thing, a very difficult decision for a young woman to make, and especially those who've been through a pregnancy, to carry a child for 9 months, to feel the growth of that life within your body, and then after you deliver that child, to never see the child again. So that's one option. The other option, of course, is for abortion, and I talked with her about the implications of abortion. In our city, Planned Parenthood has set up a counseling service for girls. I don't press for them to make any kind of decision on that first visit. In fact, I don't encourage them to make that decision at that point. I feel that they should have all of the alternatives explained to them and then have some time to think about them. And I think they should also be able to talk, preferably to another woman, if possible, about all of these implications too. And so I routinely refer them to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood in our community has a lot of doctors' wives and nurses involved in it that are doing most of this type of counseling. And I think the girls get very excellent counseling. Usually a week later or so, the girl will come back and explain to me her decision. And then we go on the basis of what her decision is at that point. One of my partners does abortions, and so I refer her to my partner, who will do his initial examination and set her up for her abortion if that's what her choice is. And then I will do the follow-up after the abortion and do all of the care afterward. I think this is the ideal situation of way abortion should be handled. I think you've got, if you've got a family physician that you already have a long-term relationship with, who is willing to support you in whatever your decision is, and to minister to you before and after, and deal with your problems, and there will be psychological problems, definitely, in whatever choice you make of the three alternatives there, I think that's the best way it can be handled for the girl. Of course, if she chooses to go through with the pregnancy, then we will minister to her in that way and help her in giving up the child for adoption, or in retaining the child and taking care of the child. So I really have a non-judgmental, I feel non-moralizing attitude towards this thing as I relate to my patients in this particular area. I would estimate I have a four-man group. We have approximately between 25 and 30,000 patients, active patient charts in our practice, and I would estimate that my partner, who does abortions, does about 25 a year, which is the combination for the four of us. In the county of Spokane last year, there were, I think, 1,300 abortions done, and 900 of them were done for teenage mothers in that city. We do, in Spokane, get girls coming from Montana and Idaho and other areas to have their abortions done in Spokane. We, since we have basically a closed type practice, don't get involved in doing those abortions, and so I don't have to deal with that particular area in my practice. I don't, let's throw the floor open now and hear what you want to say about it. Let me say, I'm not pro-abortion, I'm not con-abortion. I was talking to the village philosopher, and he says, he told me, he says, it takes a lot of guts to be wishy-washy. So I guess I got lots of guts on this particular issue.
Is it always the girl who ends up coming to alone when she's found out she's pregnant? Is it so rare for the girl to be accompanied by the father as well and to join in the discussion?
I'd say 95% of the time it's the girl alone. I do try to, I try to find out, of course, during the course of my interview, all the circumstances of it and whether the boy that's involved with it has any feelings or wants to be involved in the whole process. They are welcome to be in part of the process. They're not excluded intentionally, certainly.
But some of them end up being that way.
Huh? Most of the time they do.
Is it because they choose not to, or because the girl doesn't want them there?
No, I don't think it's because the girl doesn't want them there. In fact, I think the girls would like to have them accept the responsibility that they have for the pregnancy. I think I read most of them. I have a real feeling for these girls that they feel that they're all alone. You know, they can't turn to mom and dad, or they're afraid to turn to mom and dad. And that's one reason why I feel my role is so key, to be non-judgmental, non-moralistic with them, and try and be supportive and act as their family physician who's not emotionally involved in this particular pregnancy, but trying to help them to make what decision seems right for them and what would be in their best interest and in the pregnancy's best interest, according to the way they see it. We had a question back here.
There was an article about 2 or 3 weeks ago in one of the papers, I think I brought it with me, maybe a week ago, the family section or something like it, and it was telling where more and more the boys are becoming involved, particularly if they've got a certain amount of maturity. And in fact, this one particular article was telling about the boy that took the child.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
I was wondering if this very often happens to a girl more than once, or you know, if they feel that abortion's an easy way.
If you look at the countries that have wide open abortion, and mainly you're talking about countries like Hungary and Romania and Iron Curtain countries, they have an abortion on demand situation in those countries, and abortion is a form of birth control there. I've seen several cases of women coming back for their second abortion, which is really greatly distressing to me.
Does it hurt their body to keep going through this?
No, I really don't feel that it has. Last year, for the number of abortions that were performed, there were 7 deaths, by the way, related in the United States, medically related deaths to abortion. So you can see that before abortion, we had 500 to 6,000 estimated deaths relating to illegal abortion, and that's come down to now 7 deaths. So that's a, you know.
Just because of legalization.
Yeah, because of the legalization of it. I don't say that that's right, but I'm saying that's one of the byproducts of it.
Do you know anything of the history of abortion, whether in the United States or other places? I guess the reason I ask is that I've heard about abortion issues for a number of years, but wasn't until relatively recently that I heard statistics that from the numbers of hundreds of thousands of abortions that are performed in the United States a year, and I can't help but ask, what would happen if all those children were born alive? You partly answered my question when you said that 52% increase with pregnancies with teenagers.
Yeah, 52% increase in illegitimate pregnancies for a 14-year period.
So more young women are getting pregnant and having abortions, but throughout time, has this been something that, I mean, is it always that hundreds of thousands of babies are conceived and have been aborted throughout the world?
No, I wouldn't say so. You know, this is a modern phenomenon. I think it's especially apropos to our society. I think we're all aware of the sexuality that is thrust upon our society by Madison Avenue and the movies, the advertising, all of this kind of stuff. The new morals. And I think that this is a byproduct of that primarily. If you look at a country like, excuse me, breaking up there, Sweden, for instance, Sweden has pretty much, we've all heard about the open living situation. In fact, it's common for people, for young people in Sweden to live together for a number of years before they ever decide to marry. They don't have the problem that we have in this country with that.
Which, they don't have the pregnancy? Or
they don't have the pregnancy, the illegitimate pregnancy rate that we have, which is interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
It says something about their sexual attitudes.
Yeah, it says something about their sexual attitudes. I think it also says something, too, about their medical care, in a way, too. You know, we have, I'm talking about the issue now of birth control, alluding to the issue of birth control. We have some real negative feelings in this country about birth control, which we have a double standard for our kids on that whole issue. This
that brings up the other issue is what do you do, say, in your practice on dealing with patients who are sexually active but are not married, and do you recommend birth control?
Mm-hmm, I do. By state law, I don't have to consult with the parents at all to prescribe birth control for any teenager. And my nurse is instructed routinely when a young lady comes in and say is having her first pelvic examination to ask her if she's sexually active and would like to have birth control. And We do take care of a lot of them that way.
Likewise, it's the law in California that the parents are not to be told about abortions. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
In the state, okay, you're in a private practice. Who's going to pay for this when the parents are never supposed to be told anyway? Of course, in California, the state pays for it all. Medi-Cal pays for all abortions that are desired. So in private practice, I mean, who's going to pay for it? Parents are not permitted to know their daughter's pregnant. And,
well, that's one of the issues of the thing, you know. I mean, who does pay for it in that kind of case? I don't routinely recommend that I don't want you to give you the idea that I recommend that children not tell their parents about their pregnancy. I feel that mom and dad have a right to know, frankly. And I try to help them deal with mom and dad on the issue of the pregnancy. And I will
Planned Parenthood doesn't though.
What?
Planned Parenthood doesn't though.
No.
So
no, I know.
They don't, or, I mean, it's not that they're not.
No, they don't.
I mean, they don't have to, but it doesn't preclude.
They don't at all. Planned Parenthood doesn't.
I don't think they discourage, they don't, that I know of, they don't discourage.
They don't tell them not to, but they will never tell
no,
them this
no.
is the law. They cannot.
Yeah.
Planned Parenthood cannot.
Yeah, they cannot by law.
Just as a doctor cannot. So the parent never has the right to know their daughter's pregnant.
It's the daughter who must make the decision whether the parents will be told or not told.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's stated quite right, that the parents don't have a right. The parents may or may not
have
the right.
Legally.
No, it's that the doctors or parents do not have the right to tell the parent.
That's right.
Saying the parent doesn't have the right.
Yeah.
There's a difference between legal and moral.
Yeah.
Legal.
Yeah.
That's what she's saying, I think.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the morality of the abortion becomes then, doesn't that, not an isolated situation, but it becomes a problem of society?
I think it is. And that's why I wanted to have this discussion today, because I think it's a problem that we have to deal with. Every one of us right here.
And your abortion is due to incest?
I have seen one or two cases.
There are many more young women that have been molested than I think would your estimate.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really unbelievably awful.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to do with quite a few lately, and I can't believe it.
But isn't it really an accepted practice that in a case of incest or rape that an abortion can be performed, or a DNC can be done right after the occasion, so that actual acts of it, that really wouldn't be that much of a problem as far as our statistics. Like in Minnesota, you can, if you are raped, you can go into the emergency room and automatically have a DNC.
You're dealing then with the whole issue, though, of why women don't go into emergency rooms and report that they've been raped, too. There are a lot of social implications right there, also. There has, you know, this is where I'm talking about Congress getting involved in it. Right now, Congress and President Carter, incidentally, have totally cut out funds, or have severely limited funds for welfare abortion. And the stipulation that they have put on it is rape and incest as an indication. And then there must be a certified physical or psychiatric problems that are detrimental to the mother's health by at least three physicians. So that's the standard right now that's in play as far as an interesting thing that I'm trying to remember in mind, and some of you perhaps remember it. Sometime during the last year, there was a woman in the administration who had been appointed by Jimmy Carter to study the issue of abortion along with the panel. And she was to come back with an alternative to abortion, and she came back, her group, after 1 year of study, came back, and their essential recommendation to the president was that there is no alternative to abortion at this present time in our society. And her report was rejected, and she quit the administration. Can anybody supply me the name of the woman who did
that?
That's what I thought it was, but I couldn't.
She said there's no alternative.
There is no alternative at this present time in our society to the abortion issue.
What were her reasons?
Well, I think they involve all of the things that we're talking about today. Of the fact that it's a multiple faceted problem, and you know.
There's no alternative after the pregnancy is.
Right.
Right.
We have a phenomenon in our society of an increasing pregnancy rate among teenagers. Pregnancy out of wedlock, and the question is, how can we deal with it?
So, like better. Sexual education, better information, was not considered?
No, that was considered. Okay, but I think we have to take a look at that issue. Now, that was one of the things that I wanted to tell you from my experience, is my wife and I, this last year, after feeling a real need for this, found a course put out by, I think it was Augsburg, wasn't it, called on human sexuality, called Made Male and Female by your church. It's an excellent course. And we presented that this year in our congregation. But I first proposed it probably 3 or 4 years ago and was turned down. And it was only this year, and we've subsequently had a change in the pastors in our church and a change in feeling. And
that's the whole problem. I was active with Oxford when that course was put out, and I believe the woman who taught biology at St. Olaf College was one of the authors. And it caused such a furor when that course was published that it really, Oxford withdrew it for a while from sale. And I think that's the key issue, is that parents don't want their children taught by anybody else.
And yet
even the church, and yet the parents are not doing it themselves.
Yes, that's right.
So that if you do surveys of high school children and ask them, have they heard about sexual facts? Mm-hmm. Did they hear from their parents? Most of them will say no. So that's the big dilemma.
The year before, our teenage Sunday school class had averaged four people attendance per Sunday, and we have a 700 family congregation, 700. And Midge's and mine course had an average attendance of 20 to 30 teenagers for that particular course, and I think that was indicative of the need and the interest on the part of the kids for it.
Parents were very supportive. It was almost a relief, you know.
Yeah, you're going to relieve us of this responsibility.
You know, and somebody else can do it. And they gave us a tremendous amount of support.
And the course is...
Did you maintain your moral neutrality when you spoke within the church?
Yes, in a way, yeah. Although the material... This is what I was going to say with the material. The material is excellent for presenting the physiology of sex, okay? But it goes on from that point and talks about our very human drives and instincts and how they can come into conflict with our morals and helps you to, helps the teenager, I think, to really understand how you can get caught up in what they return, what they call in the continuum of sex within our society, which leads you right down the road until you are involved in actual sexual intercourse. And but it, as part of the course also was a frank discussion about birth control and its availability in our society nowadays for those who do get caught on the continuum and can't resist and continue on to the end. And I think that's one answer that our church has pressed to this problem. And I think that you all should be aware of that, and I'd like to see that, you know. I think that what you said about parents is the true thing. Parents don't want anybody else doing it. It's a very emotional issue, but they're, frankly, they can't deal with it themselves. They're not, the parents in our congregation should have sat in on the course. I'm sure they would have learned just as much as their teenagers did.
Maybe more.
And maybe even more. I'm sure they would have.
We've decided that if we do it again, we will do it small group, large group situations where the parents are getting the same information that the kids are. Then they will split up for talking about it into groups of just kids and just parents and parents and kids. And
then you're really beginning to equip the parents to do their job.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I think this brings up an issue about the parents, though. A friend of mine who's a pastor's wife taught a course to 100 girls. It was in different, not altogether, it was different groups. And I helped her get the test that she gave at the end. And I think that kids, you know, teenagers are not, I know this sounds very naive, but they haven't put sexuality and pregnancy together. And so they, you know, it was the percentage of girls in that 100 girls that were involved in sexual activity of some sort was quite large. But the percent of the girls who even had any idea that they could possibly get pregnant or even worried about it was very small. And none of them had considered any kind of birth control. It never entered their mind. Of course, they were younger teenagers. And I think sometimes that the education, you know, that these kids get is just very minimal. Most experimentation.
There was a plague put out, a German plague over 100 years ago, called Spring's Awakening. And it had that was the theme, which was very daring at that time. But it was the story of a young girl who asks her mother in the first act, you know, when she will have a baby. And her mother says, well, when you're in love and when you're married, you'll have a baby and get married. And second act, girl is in hay with traveling salesman or something and becomes pregnant. Third act, the girl is dying. You know, it's a melodrama, turn of the century thing. Dying in childbirth, and mother says, how could you do that, you know? And she said, Well, I asked you when I had a baby, you said when I was in love and got married, and neither of those were true. And I think that illustrates your, you know, the whole business of we think we're teaching sexuality when we say these nice things about being married and in love and never put the two together. But you raised an issue that really frightens me even more. That is when you mentioned the cost of rearing one child. And that's scary because when you start measuring the costs of a life in our society or any society, then what you say at one end of the life continuum applies at the other end. Pretty soon we'll be saying, why should we have old people past retirement age using up our resources, eating food, and they're non-productive members of society? And many of them, you know, one of the large chunks of welfare is assistance to the elderly, the blind, and the handicapped. And pretty soon we'll start saying the same thing that we do about aid for dependent children. And it really bothers me in the whole welfare scene that we always single out the aid for dependent children as the big welfare, a boogie person, instead of, you know, looking at the whole spectrum of human life.
And a good number of those, or some of those, would wish to be killed.
Do you remain
morally neutral with regard to that request?
Are you talking about elderly?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, if you look at abortion, you also have to look at euthanasia.
Well, I we're going to talk about that next week, you know.
Oh, next week.
Yeah.
We'll be around. On purpose.
I think the figure that you threw out, though, involved the cost to administer that aid, because I think the cost for you raising your child at home and the family to age 20 or age 18, somewhere along, is around $72,000. But what that $100,000 or $500,000 is you're paying a bunch of people that are on county payrolls to administer and hand out these checks. And a lot of them are promoting this sort of thing because you have to have so many files in your desk to have your job. If you reduce your files, what's left might be distributed among the other welfare agents, and you might lose your job. So the way you keep your job is keep your files full. And that goes for rentals and everything too.
I'd like to say something about public education and sex education. And I'm a bit afraid of it because it seems to raise questions in my children's mind and they come home and we talk about it. I don't know how that is in, you know, non-church related homes, but, and also I appreciated so much a high school teacher that when my daughter left junior high and her last year in middle school or junior high, whatever you call it, she wouldn't wear a dress because she said some kids said she had ugly legs. And when she got to high school, I went in orientation, you know, for this health class. And this great man teacher was teaching them to appreciate their body, you know, without saying, God gave you a body. And I really appreciate that. And so I don't think we should play down the public school thing, but if parents would know what's going on.
But see, oftentimes in the public school, I teach fifth grade, and this was my first year, and we had a film for the girls. And, you know, nobody told anybody what it was about. They went in and saw the film and answered questions. We could have gone on until Christmas for questions. The boys were given nothing, and they asked me, you know, when do we get to see our film, or what was it about? And, well, there was none. And so that was the extent in our school system. It opened up many questions, that there was a nurse there, and I, as the only woman teacher in fifth grade, was the other person who did the answering of questions. But it was a great film, but it wasn't enough. I think that it just opened up a lot of questions.
Yeah, the films that I've seen all present, they're good in presenting the physiology of sex, and that's it. And there's so much more to the issue than just the physiology or biology of it. You know, and there are a lot of parents that are very concerned. You show them that kind of material, and that shows them how it's done. And there's actually some studies done now, statistically, that do show that if that material is presented in just that way, with nothing else, there will be an increase in pregnancy rate thereafter.
Someone brought up the, used the phrase preparing parents for their job, and for the first time I questioned, what is the job of parents? And I have always thought that the ideal would be that parents would fully explain the biology and the psychology and the spirituality of our sexuality. But that usually doesn't happen, and so therefore the church or the school or Girl Scouts or whoever comes in and does their little attempted exposition. But I've always held the ideal as the mother and father preparing their children to be sexual beings. But I wonder now, if that's really possible. I have a neat relationship with my mother, but we cannot and do not talk about sexual things except in very intellectual terms. And I wonder, my home was not the place to chew these ideas. I found that it was easier to do with peers or with people a little bit older than me that I held as models. Are most children able to come home? Are most parents able to sit down and talk with their kids? And that kind of a bouncing questions off, you know, bringing up controversial issues that maybe are a little bit shocking to parents. Is that the place that we can expect that kind of interaction is really going to take place?
I don't think it is. I think that it's an emotional issue, and the parents are too involved in it emotionally to really come across to their children and give them the information and the guidance that they need. And I think it takes somebody who's an expert and is not emotionally involved with those particular children or the individual that you're trying to talk to really to give them what they need. And that's kind of what I saw as our role in our presentation in our church, you know.
It shocks me that so many young people think of relations as kind of a way of communicating. I'm sure they don't know that it increases their chance of cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of things like that they don't realize.
These are some of the things that we tried to bring out in the course. You know, there was another thing when we talked briefly about abortion, and I wanted to ask you, John. When we talk about abortion, we seem to think in terms, speak in terms of how the woman, how the mother reacts. And when we list the death rate from abortion, we don't list the fetal death rate, we list the maternal death rate. We don't ever, or seldom do we consider suffering from the point of view of what the fetus goes through. And I know that in our class, the day that I talked about that, their mouths were hanging open, their lower jaws are practically touching the floor, because they had, and this is in a church situation, had assumed that abortion is just a sterile maneuver. You pop in, you have it, you pop out, and that cleanly takes care of the whole issue. And they didn't realize that the fetus as a living organism or a human being, you have to consider it one of those two things, suffers terribly from the suction, from the saline, goes through horrible throes. And whether we can say they yet have pain, they have no understanding of what they're going through, but they are going through that, nevertheless. And I think what I'm trying to ask you is, I don't think it's fair for anyone who's considering an abortion to make the decision without knowing these things. And how often are these pregnant women and pregnant girls informed about things from the fetus side?
I don't know. I don't know of anybody who would attempt to do anything like that.
Why?
It's more like...
I've seen some pro-life, pro-life group has a...
Yeah, they have...
That, actually, we had in our living room with friends, or they were women who came and looked at these things, and not kids. But it showed the slide of what happens to a fetus with this saline solution and so forth. Just mind-blowing to all of us. There is a possibility, I suppose, I don't know whether women would do it, but there is a possibility that this lies for teenagers.
John, I feel a little uncomfortable about some of the things that I've heard said this morning. And I hope some of the parents feel this discomfort. But I thought I heard you say that you didn't feel that it was the parents' place to give this sex education or this counseling to the children.
No, I didn't say that. If I can interrupt you to clarify that. What I'm saying is that it's extremely difficult for the parents to do it because they're so emotionally involved with their children. And I don't think they can do the job of educating their children that a person who's not emotionally involved with the children can do for them. That's what I'm saying. Now, the ideal situation would be for the parents to do it, and I think that's, you know, that is the ideal situation, frankly, but I don't, it's very, very rare that a parent is equipped and emotionally and technically able to do this, to perform this function for their children.
I guess maybe if you depend on what, you know, one you find is being equipped, if you're talking, you know, technically, if you mean from a medical point or a doctor's point of view or whatever, then I probably agree. But if equipped means knowing something about sex, you know, the fact that you've had children yourself, have gone through this sexual act, I think at least you're partly equipped.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
In a technical sense. And I guess the thing that I was feeling uncomfortable about was that I was sort of hearing that we should, at least in most cases, because the parent wasn't emotionally able to sit down with the child, that in most cases this should be taken out of the home. And it should be done by the doctor, or it should be done by the minister, or the school, or, you know, some other person. It seems to me sex education isn't in the fifth grade, sitting down and watching a film, or isn't going to the doctor when you're a teenager, or to your minister, but it's a lifelong process, at least from the time a young child can start to talk, until a person is 18, leaves home, whatever. And questions always seem to come up about where did I come from, and how are babies made, and it's something that goes on continually.
Yes, it is, and I think it's been determined, I don't know how you can statistically determine something like this, but I've heard statements to the effect that most of the sexual influence that teenagers, by the time they're teenagers, children have been subjected to is influence from outside the home. Even with children who are instructed in the home, for whom it has been a constant growing thing, this sex education process, that what they're subjected to nowadays outside of the home is really overbalancing what they're picking up in the home. And when we had a session with the parents, and it was interesting that they aren't tuned in to all these other informational things that the kids are getting. I mean, just we told them to listen to rock and roll and listen to the radio stations. You'd be amazed what they're learning from that.
Is this sort of a cop-out on the part of the parents, well, they're getting it and we don't have to do it?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I think in fairness to the
parents. Fear, more just the fear of sex. I mean, the whole, I think, going back generations, I think the whole fatalistic attitude towards sex was that was just something that was denied. Mm-hmm. You don't talk about that.
I think in fairness to parents, though, that you have to say that although, you know, these kids are subjected all along to, like she's saying, outside the home, there comes a time that those of you raised teenagers realize that, just like she said, she had a good relationship with her mother, but she doesn't want to talk sex. And I think that teenagers reach a place that they'll talk to anybody but their parents, because it's normal rebellion that's within them, and I don't think it's really a parent-child relationship. I think it's a normal part of adolescence.